medical community proudly presents the JDE Connection, a Quest On Air podcast production.
This podcast explores and showcases how JDE customers are harnessing specific functionality and capabilities to drive business success.
Hello, JDE Connection listeners. Welcome back. I'm Chandra Wabshaw, one of your podcast hosts, and I'm the Business Solutions Lead at Colas IS Support. With me this week, and most weeks, is my friend and podcast partner, Paul Hauk Cooper, Vice President of JD Edwards Product Development at Oracle. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Chandra. So glad to be here this week. Jeez, wouldn't want to miss another week, make you fly solo again.
I know.
Jeez. I have to figure out how many weeks in a row do I have to be here before I get the every week tag back, sticker back, badge back, whatever it happens to be. Jeez. Who knows? Fun time. So what's going on with you these days?
Well, first of all, I was traveling for work this week. So I was in Southern California and the temperatures were lovely. And you know what? There's humidity. I almost forgot about humidity.
Yeah, there can be moisture in there, unlike the dry, arid desert of Colorado.
Yeah. Yeah, and I could smell greenery. It was awesome.
Nice.
It made my week.
That's great. And I'm still recovering from strep, as you can tell.
I hear that. I was hoping you would shake that while I was gone.
No, I'm on day 9 or 10 or whatever of my antibiotics and can't hack it up yet. I'm getting there, though. I'm getting there.
Good.
Gradually.
You're feeling better, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, everything started to work right away and immediately felt better. And then every day has just been just a little bit. So it's like made that big jump and then I've just been chipping away day after day. So hopefully this next week I'll kick it, but we'll see.
Well, in other news, I also wanted to highlight something. We actually have listeners.
No.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought they'd just download, but they never listen.
I know. I actually got messages from two people in the last couple weeks. One messaged me to say the puppy chow that we recorded at the end of the year in one of our episodes in our Midwesternism was a huge hit with their family. So I thought
fantastic.
That was pretty cool.
I'm glad our Midwesternisms are resonating. Who knows if anybody's used any of the other JD Edwards knowledge we've dispelled.
Right. The other piece of news was that in last week's episode, the comment I made that said, my dad always said, if it's not at Mills, I don't need it. I got a text confirming that from one of our listeners.
Oh, that's awesome.
Said, your dad is right.
Well, I'm sure dad would be happy to hear that too. That's cool. That's awesome. Very cool. I'm glad people are listening. You know, we want to keep it fun and entertaining, and I'm glad the fun and entertaining component is resonating with folks. So that's pretty cool. So today, I believe we're going to continue our conversation with Nathan about IIBA and BABIC principles. We ended up talking to Nathan, geez, well over an hour. It was fantastic. And today, the bulk of the conversation is really focused on how do you get the most out of it? And can it actually apply outside of, let's say, a BA role, which is very interesting. So hopefully people find it beneficial and hopefully they're curious about BABIC and IIBA and they'll go explore it. But before we get there, I did want to ask you, having had this nice conversation with Nathan, what was your biggest takeaway from what he had to say and his description of BABIC?
For me, I find, as I look back at my career, I've learned more of my BA skills organically, whether it's being paired up with another business analyst and learning from them. Because again, I came through the business, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the traits that I have is I do ask a lot of questions. You know, well, why do we do this? Why do we do it this way? Well, what is the meaning of that? And that's just innate in who I am. So I think that's been helpful. But I've never had any formal business analyst training, even going through like an MBA program, which I did years ago. The topics that are covered are very different. For me, I feel like this is something that would be really valuable for me as well to pursue a certification, because I think it could be helpful whether I'm managing an ERP with a team of developers, a team of business analysts, you know, to help coach them to have a formal process around rather than what ever process I've been using, which it's not that it's wrong. It's just, I feel like it could be better.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, what you've developed organically is definitely works and is strong. It's just here you have this structure, right? You actually have a nice structure that you can apply this to, and it can help reinforce some of the stuff that you already learned, as well as maybe expose you to a few things that you didn't realize you were missing, so to speak. But I really like that idea that whether it's working as a BA or, let's say, coaching BAs, managing BAs, you could get benefit out of this because you could give them a framework to work from.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, with that, why don't we get back to our conversation with Nathan and find out how he thinks you can get the most out of IIBA and BABIC.
Sounds great.
You know, something as we're going through, and this is off the AI topic, so kind of switching back a little bit, but when it comes to learning this process and taking this certification, based on your experience, Nathan, would you do it as the first thing out of the box when you become a business analyst, or does it help to have a little bit more experience so that as you go through the BABIC, you have something to apply it to, something to relate to? Is it better on a blank sheet of paper, or is it better with a little bit of history?
I would definitely say, and obviously I can only speak based off of my experience, but I would definitely say having history behind it. There's a lot of things referenced in there that I just don't think I would fully understand without having a little bit of background in history. For example, if I've never seen our internal development documentation, I might not know why there are certain elements that are being presented within the BABIC itself, especially the techniques. There's about 50 techniques in there, and some of them we always done, right? So for example, process flows, those are in there. BAs have done plenty of process flows, but actually going through and building them out, and there's a little bit of an art to building a process flow. You can't just do it. So having a little bit of that background and understanding, okay, I have a process flow, but I'm mapping out a large thing. How much detail do I have? Where do I stop? Where do I add more detail going down? So on and so forth. I know I'm rambling a little bit, but there is just so much of that context that's important. And actually, one of my biggest things that I heard throughout all the BABIC information is a lot of the things that comes down to sentences will end on based on your context or based off of that context. And so it's very much of, well, you have to understand all of the situation that may be going on, that if you don't really quite have a background in business or your organization, it might not sink in. If I was just starting, I probably would have started off with the ECBA, which I didn't take, but that's the entry level exam. So that's much more focused on terminology and things like that. So if you're sitting somewhere, you can go, oh, I know what that term is. I know the definition and a little bit of how that's applied. And then that can kind of help you build your experience rather than jumping into the higher level certifications to start with.
Yep. Makes sense. A bit of a loaded question, I suppose, but I kind of figured that would be the answer. I mean, this is a complicated process. This is a complicated job. And these are complicated concepts. And with no context, with no background, they sound great in theory, but I would assume that you're going to take more value, get more value out of it, and be able to appreciate what's being recommended better when you have a canvas to throw it against. I've found that even when I started out my career, after developer immersions, they threw me in the manufacturing class, right? And it was supposed to be a 3-week long class, but they didn't want me to be gone for 3 weeks. So what they had was a bunch of the developers that were already working in manufacturing give me a 5-day class. And so they just jammed all of manufacturing through my head in 5 days. So not instructor led, but developer led, all that, right? And here I am brand new to manufacturing. I then took that same class, but the full-fledged 2 or 3 week class, whatever it was, a year later. And I remember walking into the lady that ran development at the time. I ran into her in the elevator and she asked, what are you doing down here? Because I was coming from where the university was. And I said, oh, I'm taking manufacturing. She's like, wait, haven't you been developing in manufacturing for over a year? I said, oh, yeah. I said, but I thought I would take it again because it was weeks worth of material just jammed through my head and I had no basis. I had no context. I said, now I'm taking it after a year of being here. This all makes so much more sense and I'm getting so much more out of this. And it was funny because she looked at me. She goes, you know, that totally makes sense. And we should probably do that more often rather than just jam it through your head and, oh, by the way, trial by fire after that. How about we ease you into this and we'll teach you more when you can actually absorb more? Because it's almost a waste, because I didn't even know what area of the product I was going to be working on. So I didn't even know where to focus. And you can imagine it's a big, long process, right? You know, manufacturing. So do you focus on PDM? Do you focus on shop floor control? Do you focus on accounting? Do you focus on MRP? What are you going to focus on, right?
I think that's a great point. And then it just clicked in my mind, like my experience coming from the infrastructure background, I had no idea. And I had worked at my company for 4 years. And Mark, the BA at the time, we used to ask, like, well, what does Mark do? And we'd always joke around saying, well, Mark analyzes the business, right? And like, but at the end of the day, all of us in infrastructure, we knew Mark did a bunch of important stuff, but no one can actually explain what he did. And I think that this kind of drives home the point. I think if I was to be starting in a business analysis role, I'd really just focus on the business itself, trying to get your hands into processes and seeing how people are doing things and building out those relationships. And that will really guide you through. I imagine if you're in a JD Edwards shop, there's already enough business analysis stuff set up. There's some sort of structure and process that you can learn the business and figure out how your department does something. And then once you have some of that context, then you can go in and learn the Babok and see, okay, now I understand we do things this way and the business does it this way. I can apply X, Y, and Z, because we spoke about it a little bit earlier, but a lot of JD Edwards clients aren't full software development shops. But the Babok is meant for people in all sorts of industries and all sorts of varying levels of technology. So if I had learned it up front, I'd be probably trying to jam pack all 50 techniques in and utilize everything that I've learned. I wouldn't have known what was appropriate at the time. And so understanding that context, I think, is important to know when and why to apply a technique before learning what the technique is.
Great advice.
Kind of like the diagram you sent on the back.
Yeah, the mind map.
Yeah. Just go ahead and Google mind map, Babok. You'll see what we mean.
Yeah, it looks like Chandra's usual running trail on a Saturday, actually.
Kind of does, actually. Actually, you know what it reminds me of? This is my time in Florida. It's the spaghetti models that come out when a hurricane is coming. They publish spaghetti models on it. And when I first got down there, I'm like, spaghetti models? Well, I see why they call them that now. This kind of looks like a spaghetti model to me.
Honestly, the first thing I think of for some reason is if someone put a tracker on me when I lose my car keys and all the different places that I'm looking around the house, and then I end up back to where I looked in the first place.
Yes.
That's awesome.
All over the place.
I love it. Good. Well, obviously, we hinted at this earlier. You have changed roles recently out of the business analyst realm, if you will, and are now in IT planning and governance, if I'm not mistaken. You're the IT planning and governance advisor now, correct? Still at the same company.
Right. Correct. Still at Ajinomoto.
So how does what you've kind of gained, both your experiences as a business analyst, but also the knowledge that you obtained through the Babok and your IIBA certification, how has that kind of helped you? And how will it help you in this role?
I think it's going to help tremendously. So going way back, me going from infrastructure to business analysis, that was a night and day switch. That was a hard transition versus this transition I find to be much smoother because there's so many related components. Now, granted, I am learning a lot of new things every day. And in the areas that I may just not have a great feel on, that's when I can lean on the Babok, for example. So one of the topics that we're discussing is, well, how do we intake and prioritize requests from the business and what are the things to do? And so my brain instantly switched to like, okay, well, I don't know the normal process of how an organization would do this, but I know, just like the Babok, the current state, the future state, understanding your risk and having a strategy from getting from one to another, many of the same components as I would have when we're looking at a series of projects and demands to fulfill for the organization. As we all know, there's far more ask of IT than what we could ever fulfill. And so one of the important parts of the role is, are we getting all of the needs of the business? Are we fully vetting these out and doing it thoroughly enough to where we can quantifiably choose which project to go with, right? Based off of many factors, not only financial, but level of risk for my agile folks, the t-shirt size, mm-hmm. you know, do we do a bunch of small projects versus a couple big ones? What resources are aligned to other projects, and really going through that, not only within IT, but within the business as well, to really make sure that we're driving enough value and meeting the business need as best as we can with the resources we have.
Not just the who screamed loudest?
Not that's, just,
I mean,
who screamed
isn't loudest? That, I thought that's how all businesses did it.
Yeah. Who's applying enough pressure on
me? Uh-huh. Right. Exactly.
But yeah, so we're setting that up within the organization and almost a, like a board, for example, but it should hopefully continue past that. We alluded to it earlier. How are we measuring? Was this project actually successful? For example, we're supposed to save $1 million by implementing a solution over 5 years. Well, who's checking in annually to make sure that, well, are we on track with that? Is this costing us more? You know, should we mm-hmm. come up with a different strategy? Are we getting our value? And then also just at the end of each project, are we doing our lessons learned? And our lessons learned should be in a very neutral way. I feel like it normally has a negative connotation. Like, what did we do wrong that we can improve upon next time? But maybe the question should be flipped and, well, what did we do a really good job of to make sure we capture that and do it mm-hmm. next time? But going through that exercise of lessons learned, it really allows things to sink in and you're being intentional about realizing what went right and wrong within a project and how can you improve the business going forward rather than just, oh, we're done with the project. Hypercare is over. Hopefully there's a little bit of a break where you can catch up on your incidents and tickets and then start another one. And I feel like that's where a lot of organizations are stuck at.
I would agree. There's not probably enough time spent on it. And part of it is the business wants so much or needs so much. And then you throw on support issues, right? Where those of us that are in the JD Edwards space as business analysts tend to provide a lot of support as well. We're not just dedicated to the larger projects where we're out doing the gathering of the requirements and talking with our business users. We're heavily involved in, we got a problem here. How do we fix it? Testing those fixes, et cetera. So it does become very much something I don't think that enough organizations spend the time to adequately plan it out, especially knowing that you're going to have support. It's going to be in there. You're just going to have to accept that and figure out what percentage of time really is that. And that's where you have available resources.
Right. I think that's a perfect point. No person is going to have 100% capacity at any point, right? You might have a business analyst where 30% of their time is KTLO, right? Keeping the lights on. How do we keep the business running? 30% could be allocated to that. And 14% of their time could be allocated for vacation and sick days and trips to the water cooler, so on and so forth. And then, well, now Nathan has, forget what the math on that was, but something 44% of my time is taken up. Well, now I have another 30% that is on ad hoc orchestrations and UDOs and little things that the business is asking for that doesn't need a project. So really now I'm only dedicated to 30-40% to be able to work on a project. And well, okay, that's great. But what about the consideration of, well, we have another project that's starting in 6 weeks that Nathan needs to use 60% of his time on. And now you're really going through this balancing act, almost like Tetris, of how do we get all these pieces to fit together to be used optimally? And it's going to be a challenge and it's going to be interesting because everyone's project's important to them and everyone's trying to show that they're providing value to the business and improving. And it's going to be a very good test of being data-driven and diligent, but also navigating the business's needs.
And having that empathy for the business, having the empathy for the people in general to understand that we are asking a lot of you. Absolutely. And we want to set them up for success. We don't want people leaving because they don't feel like they can be successful because you're expecting them to do 100% on this project, but they still have to keep the lights on over here, which honestly does require 30% of their time. And oh, that's right, vacation. I forgot about that. Oh, yeah, we allow that. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, you have to make up that time. That's what I heard.
Does feel like that at some
point. It does feel like that sometimes.
Yeah.
You never want to be on one of those projects where they actually tell you, we only expect this to take 25% of your time, but then you find out that the expectations for performance for the results would require 100% of your time. So you're constantly falling short because expectations are completely out of alignment with reality. So
I would love to bring up another reason why this role is needed, especially with the emergence of SaaS technologies and online subscriptions, so on and so forth. If we can't deliver as an IT department enough value to the business, what's preventing someone in a department from just saying, okay, I'm not going to bring this up to IT. We're just going to use this subscription service that no one's ever heard of to do what we need to do. And it's really difficult. And years ago, everything would have had to funnel through IT department. But now,
right,
someone with a company credit card and a manager that's willing to approve it can go out and start deploying their own solutions. And they're not even thinking of all the risks around data governance and security. And what are they doing with my information, so on and so forth. And then it could also get to the point of, well, we're using this a bunch. How can I integrate this with my ERP data? And it's like, you know, you're using that. What is this tool? And so it's just a real challenge, I think, that is becoming more and more prevalent, especially with AI agents, things of that nature, to not have such a fragmented array of solutions and things to secure and things to govern and keeping track all of it. Even the one solution that someone chooses, it could be easier, but if JD can do 90% of it, well, now that's going to give us less admin overhead. We don't have to learn different systems. We don't have to figure out SSO and offboarding and what's happening with our data. That's a consideration that I think a lot of times businesses miss, right? They just see the value to their team. It all has to be considered because there's so many times where JD has something and there's just such a preference to see a bolt-on solution that is shiny and can do some stuff, but the average business user is not thinking integration and security and how long it takes to support something and things of that nature. So it's a role that I imagine more organizations are going to need, especially if headcount can start being reallocated between, okay, maybe we don't need so many just developers now, but maybe we need more business analysts, or maybe we need more people focusing on data governance. I think as things change with AI, I think roles are going to change a lot, and we have to be willing to adapt to the skill sets and the needs of the business, because in a lot of ways, I think they're just shifting.
Well, I think that's extremely insightful and spot on.
I agree with that 100%. I know there's been so many times where I've walked into something and I'm like, why are we doing this? JDE does this natively. And then you're building integrations and you're absolutely worried about your SSO and your onboarding and your offboarding. What happens when these users are no longer here? What happens when that user comes back? You know, sometimes they leave and then they come back. What is the process flow and how does it work over here? And how do we integrate it into JDE? What is the best integration methodology to use? So
what happens when the integration fails?
Breaks.
Right.
Who's responsible? Right. Well, who's going to support this once we're live on it? And it usually ends up falling in IT, not even just the integration, but the tool itself, because we implemented it. Well, we implemented it by, we built the integrations. You guys did the configuration maybe with a partner or the software company itself, but it ends up falling in IT's lap.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, they go off and spin up their own solution, take an off-the-shelf piece of software, and they start using it. You start asking them these sorts of questions, and the answer is, well, we don't care. You guys figure it out. You're IT. You're the ones that'll figure it out. You'll figure out the answers to all those questions that you had, Nathan. We don't have to figure it out. All we have to do is use the product that we want to use to do the business. You figure out how to stitch it together and do all that other fun stuff. Not our problem.
Right.
Or they get into it, and then they're like, this doesn't do it like JDE, or this doesn't do that. They didn't do a good job of defining their own requirements to realize what said bolt-on can or cannot do.
And then you're left with trying to fill the gap. So now you've got a bolt on you didn't even know you had, that a branch decided to start using, that you've now got to integrate. Not only do you have to integrate and account for it, but you have to actually fill any gaps that it has because the users are upset with it. It's like, oh, great.
And how often is there a system out there that does deliver on what it promised and it's not doing all the things you want, but now it costs more to undo it. So now you got to just kind of live with this thing until it becomes deprecated. And then you have another business leader that comes in and it's like, well, we should use Bolton Y instead of Bolton X. And then now you're doing another integration. And it's like, how did we get here?
Yes.
Like, have we thought about maybe it being a business process?
Right. Exactly.
Issue
exactly.
Or a training issue.
Yeah. Can we get a gatekeeper here? Maybe. I mean, just maybe.
And hopefully that's what all of this culminates into.
Yeah.
And go back to your original question. I think in my mind, the BABOK has two distinct areas. This isn't defined anywhere. This is my own opinion, but tactical business analysis and strategic business analysis. Mm-hmm. And so now I feel like I'm just flipping between one and the other. The tactical side is building out a requirement to give it to a developer or fill out a business case, so on and so forth, like the actionable things that need to be done to complete the work. And now I feel like I'm more of, well, what's the strategy of the right thing to do for then to eventually get handed off to a BA to go ahead and execute it?
Right.
I like it.
Sides of the same coin, I guess.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And have fun to the editor trying to figure out how I just went on a complete tangent in the middle of a conversation.
So, but hey, we do it all the time.
Welcome to the world of the mind of Nathan over here.
Looks
squirrel.
Like, yep, exactly. Yeah. Back to the mind map again, right?
Yeah. It's embedded. It's embedded in there.
Awesome. Well, Paul, do you have any other further questions for Nathan?
I do not. I've exhausted my list.
Right. I know we could continue our conversation.
Absolutely.
That's just how we are. I think the three of us could probably talk for hours about different experiences and how we might change the world if we ruled the world, right?
Right.
I want to thank you, Nathan, for coming on and talking with us and shedding some light on the IIBA and the certifications that are out there and how it's helped you. And maybe for those in the community that have thought about it, that maybe want to learn a little bit more, they've been in that role for just a little bit, and maybe they want some knowledge specific to business analysis to help them improve or maybe help their organization improve. I think it would be great for me to take the certification or at least read the BABOK. I know that there's things I can learn because there's always things I can learn. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes back to early on when we were talking about what makes a good BA. It's that curiosity. How can I improve? How can I do things better?
100%. Yeah. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's been fun.
It's been a great conversation, Nathan. Really appreciate your time. All right. Well, as we close out this week's episode, we just want to say thank you to Nathan for spending time with us. As we talked about earlier, we talked for well over an hour and learned quite a bit about IIBA, about BABOK, about the various certifications that are available, and really kind of dug in deep as to where you can apply it and the benefit that you can get out of it. And as you can tell, he is enthusiastic about this and has spent a lot of time kind of refining his understanding of it and applying it. He's got some great insight on how to apply it, which is fantastic. So for those that are interested in IIBA and BABOK and potentially taking one of those certifications that he mentioned, we will include those links in the notes, show notes for you. But we couldn't end an episode, of course, without a Midwesternism. Now, we did start off this episode chatting a little bit about a few Midwesternisms of the past. But before we get into this week's, I did want to mention, we didn't quite cover everything about Mills Fleet Farm. There was one little fact that you left out, and that is, where did Mills actually originate?
Well, actually, so Stuart C. Mills Sr. founded Mills Companies in Brainerd, Minnesota in 1922.
I've got family that lived in Brainerd, so I'm actually familiar with Brainerd, which is...
Oh, wow.
Anyway, continue.
Good fishing up there. The family then created an oil company and opened a dealership and auto parts stores. And then Fleet Farm was actually created or founded in 1955 by Stuart Mills Sr. and his sons, Henry Mills II and Stuart Mills Jr. That first store, which was named Fleet Wholesale Supply, was opened in Marshfield, Wisconsin.
See, there's the fact. And Marshfield, Wisconsin was right down the road from where I was actually born and grew up in Wisconsin, Rapids, Wisconsin. It's like 40 minutes away, which is kind of crazy. So
small world.
It's a small world. And, you know, we also found out that headquarters is currently in Appleton, Wisconsin. So they may have started out in Minnesota, but they moved to the right state, obviously. So.
Or they were traitors, one of the two.
Oh, well, you know, they followed the better team. Okay, moving on. What's this week's Midwesternism?
Well, we're going to continue on with some of these Midwest stores, and we're going to talk about Menards.
Oh, nice. Can you sing the jingle is my question. Don't ask me because I can't. I can't remember it, but.
You can't?
I can't. I can hear it in my head, but I can't. I don't remember the words. Sorry.
I don't think people want to hear me sing, but it's save big money at Menards or something like that. See, as I said, people don't want to hear me sing. I only sing in the car with music. There's a reason.
There used to be a game, it's called Logo, and you actually had to know all the jingles. I don't know that Menards was ever there because it was kind of a Midwestern specific thing.
Yes.
But
correct.
Anyway,
you are
that
correct.
Would have been it. So, and you would win. So there you go. Good job. All right. Tell us about Menards.
Yes. It is a privately owned American home improvement retailer. They actually have over 300 stores, primarily, again, in the Midwest. They're known for a very vast selection of building materials. They usually have their own lumber yards at each store. They have tools. They have home goods. They even have groceries and household items. They kind of offer that one-stop shop experience, which I think Midwesterners are very much a fan of. Just get it all at one spot, right? And they have pretty strong customer loyalty because they have a very popular rebate program. I believe it's like 11% back a lot of purchases. And this one is also headquartered in Wisconsin, Eau Claire.
Eau Claire. Oh, nice.
Eau Claire. Yeah,
oh, that's awesome.
Yep. And it was, I think, started in 1958, if I recall.
So it's funny that you mentioned the one-stop shop, because as you were describing this, I'm like, wow, what is it with Midwestern-based stores and being this like catch-all thing? And it's got to be a Midwestern thing. I mean, they just, you only want to make one stop on the way home and just want to make it easy, efficient, convenient, simple. Not to mention that if you go to just one place all the time, chances are you're going to get to know the staff. You're going to start recognizing some of the other customers, some of the other patrons,
yep.
And you'll end up sitting there talking about your second grade teacher or whatever it was, if I recall, at Sprouts a little while ago. Or no, that wasn't Sprouts. Where was that?
Well, it used to be under the same umbrella as Sprouts, but it's called Fresh Thyme. It looks very similar to the Sprouts. It's in Rochester. Yes, I did have a run-in with somebody. We got to chatting, as we do in the Midwest when you're in your checkout line getting your groceries. And turns out my sixth grade teacher, she knew, because my sixth grade teacher was from a smaller town called Preston, Minnesota, in southeast Minnesota. And she knew the name, which it's hard not to. So, yeah, it was quite funny. We had a good conversation about the Kinneberg family. So
I just started laughing. I'm like, I should either hit record because we need this on the podcast, or, you know, I need evidence of a Midwestern goodbye in the checkout aisle. Anyway, it was awesome. That was very, very cool.
Yes. Yes. All right. For questions, feedback, or ideas for future episodes, contact us at the JDE Connection at questoraclecommunity.org. Until next time, let's keep learning, sharing, and most importantly, laughing together. Toodles.
See ya. Thank you for tuning in for today's episode of the JDE Connection, a Quest On Air podcast production. Show notes and links can be found at questoraclecommunity.org/JDE Connection.
To learn more about what's happening in the Quest JD Edwards community, visit our website at questoraclecommunity.org/JD Edwards.